A few weeks back, Sid introduced us to the imprecatory psalms and did a fantastic job of explaining to us the balance between a love for the enemy and a hate for the sin that they had committed against God and against His people. Granted, the imprecatory psalms are difficult for all of us in some fashion, in some way. Whether we have a hard time understanding completely what could be said about the Lord who is a loving God and yet could wipe out and destroy a nation completely. Or it may be the fact that we have a difficult time loving our enemy as we should. I want us to turn to Psalm 83. I want to look at this psalm together for just a few minutes, point out some observations about the psalm. And then draw some applications from it. There's a quote by C.S. Lewis that says, "Consequently, Christianity does not want us to reduce by one atom the hatred we feel for cruelty and treachery. We ought to hate them. Not one word of what we have said about them needs to be unsaid. But it does want us to hate them in the same way in which we hate things in ourselves. Being sorry that the man should have done such things and hoping, if it is any way possible, that somehow, sometime, somewhere, he can be cured and made human again." With that quote in mind, I want us to look at Psalm 83, a psalm supposedly the last psalm of Asaph. In verse 1 it says, "O God, do not keep silence. Do not hold your peace. Or be still, O God, for behold, your enemies make an uproar. Those who hate you have raised their heads. They lay crafty plans against your people. They consult together against your treasured ones. They say, 'Come, let us wipe them out as a nation. Let the name of Israel be remembered no more.' For they conspire with one accord against you. They make a covenant. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebel and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre, Ashur also has joined them. They are the strong arm of the children of Lot. Do to them as you did to Midian, as to Sisera and Jabin at the river Kishon, who were destroyed at Endor, who became dung for the ground. Make their nobles like Oreb and Zeb, all their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, 'Let us take possession for ourselves of the pastures of God.' O my God, make them like whirling dust, like chaff before the wind. As fire consumes the forest, as the flame sets the mountains ablaze, so may you pursue them with your tempest and terrify them with your hurricane. Fill their faces with shame, that they may seek your name, O Lord. Let them be put to shame and dismayed forever. Let them perish in disgrace, that they may know that you alone, whose name is the Lord, are the Most High over all the earth." Just by way of general observation, we see that Asaph is the supposed writer. Asaph was appointed by David to be the chief of the musicians in his court in 1 Chronicles chapter 15 and verse 16 through 17. We see here in Psalm 83 that the recipient of this prayer is the Lord. Asaph comes before the Lord and is going to present to him the problem that he and his people are facing. The main characters in this psalm are, the first is the main character, which is God. The enemies of God are coming against the Lord primarily, and then against His people. And then we see that there are 10 enemies that Asaph will mention. The enemies of God include Edom, Ishmaelites, the Moab, Hagrites, Gebel, Ammon, Amalek, Philistia, Tyre, and Asher, in some translations, which is also Assyria. What's the content of this passage? I think it's probably pretty simple to understand that the content is simply a national lament of Asaph, praying that God intervene and take a stand against his enemies, which are beyond number, too many for them to handle. And so because of that, there are two themes that are addressed by Asaph. First of all, that there's this theme of an action being taken by the enemy of God. He says that they're crafty and evil. But then there's also a request that God take action. The enemy is rising up against God and his people, so he asks the Lord to take action and to destroy them and wipe them off the face of the earth. Those are just some simple observations about this psalm. I want to look at interpreting the psalm now. In order to do that, in order to interpret any passage in the Bible, I think it's important that we ask ourselves what the text would have meant to the original recipients. In verse 1, it says, "O God, do not keep silence. Do not hold your peace or be still, O God." So we begin with Asaph addressing the Lord and asking God, the Most High over all the earth, not to sit still any longer, but to take action for you and the sake of your people. We see a sense of urgency in Asaph. There's a sense that something needs to be done. He sees these enemies coming up against them, too many for them to handle. And it seems as though that they're going to lose, that the enemies of God are going to stand. And so there is a sense of urgency. Asaph is correct. And he turns to the one who can help. He turns to the Lord. Verse 2 through 5, we see that the enemy of God is one that's making an uproar. We see that they have this hatred, this disdain for God, the Most High. There is no respect. There is no reverence to God, which is why that they're raising their heads against him. And so they're devising a plan to attack the Lord and to attack his people. He says that they're crafty. Their craftiness may be reminiscent of Balak and Balaam in Numbers 31 and verse 16, which led, as you all may know, to the disaster that took place in Bel Peor in Numbers chapter 24. In verse 4, it says, "They say, come, let us wipe them out as a nation. Let the name of Israel be remembered no more." This was their ultimate plan, to wipe them out so that they were no longer remembered. And if you recall in their past history, when God was used the 10 plagues to defeat the Egyptians and to take his people into the land of Canaan, he did that so that all nations would know who the Lord was. And so for these nations to wipe out Israel forever, to be remembered no more, would take away what the Lord had wanted all along, that his name be remembered forever. Notice also that this is more directed towards God than it is directed towards his people. In verse 3, "They lay crafty plans against your people." Verse 5, "For they conspire with one accord against you. They make a covenant." There's more of a hatred towards the Lord than there is against Asaph or against the Israelites. And then verse 6 through 8, the 10 enemies are introduced. There are 10 nations that hate the Lord. Edom, which was a descendant of Esau. The Ishmaelites, which came from Abraham and Hagar. The Moabites, which came from Lot. The Hagrites, considered possibly a nomadic tribe, living in the east of the Jordan and possibly descendants of Hagar. Gebel, which is, by all accounts, somewhat unknown, although their location seems to be somewhat in the area of the Phoenician city. The Ammonites, which were descendants of Lot. The Amalekites, which were descendants from Esau. And looking at stories from Exodus chapter 17, you can see Moses, when he was had his arms up, they were winning the battle, but when his arms got tired, they were losing the battle to the Amalekites. And then you have in 1 Samuel chapter 15 that they were supposed to be utterly destroyed by Saul, and yet he did not do that. You have Tyre, and then you have Asher, who was the Syrian northern army who took Israel into captivity, and the Philistines, who would have been the one that that Asaph would have been familiar with, because those were the ones that were against Saul and against David, a thorn in their side for most of their reign. And then you have in verse 9 through 12 an interesting thing that happens. Asaph has a request. He asks that the Lord mirror the judgment and the terror that he poured forth on the nations in times past. And what's interesting here is that these are stories of the judges. The judges were raised up to deliver God's people from their enemies, which was exactly what Asaph is asking of the Lord here, to deliver us from our enemies. But one of the things that's interesting here is that he does not ever mention the judges by name. He leaves them out. What possibly could be the reason for Asaph doing this? Well, if we look at it a little bit more closely, we'll see that this is Asaph's dependence upon the Lord. It's him showing God that you are the one that was in control the whole time. It never was the judges who were victorious. It had always been the Lord. He was the one who wiped their enemies off the face of the earth. And so he shows his dependence in the Lord by not mentioning the judges by name. And then verse 13 through 16, we have the imprecatory language that is used. Oftentimes in the Psalms, it is used by way of similes and metaphors. In verse 13, it says he makes them like whirling dust, like chaff before the wind, and destroy them, God, in other words, and make them vanish from our sight. In verse 14, as fire destroys vegetation, may the Lord destroy them. And metaphorically speaking, talking about God's anger, let his anger and his power burn against this nation, these nations. Yet while there is a request for them to be demoralized and vanquished forever, notice the purpose of Asaph's imprecatory request. In verse 16, it's so that they may seek the Lord. While God punishes the evil, he is also abounding with mercy and with love and maintains a gracious nature while judging righteously. And then in verse 17 through 18, it says that let them be put to shame and dismayed forever. Let them perish in disgrace. The psalmist shows his confidence in the Lord. And verse 17 shows that the Lord will hear and act. We're never told whether God answered Asaph's prayer. But it is interesting that his confidence is such that he knew that the Lord's will would be done. I want us to think about three important lessons that I think we can learn from Asaph and from his prayer of imprecations to the Lord. The first lesson I want us to think about is the fact that we must trust in the Lord's vindication and not our own. On the outset, that seems very simple, that we give it over to the Lord and let him deal with the situations that are at hand. But I want us to look at Romans chapter 12. I think Paul presents for us something a bit more of a challenge than what we might think on the outset. Romans chapter 12, it's interesting that these two verses are put together. In verse 19, Paul says, "Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine. I will repay,' says the Lord." So right off the bat, Paul says, leave it to the Lord. He will vindicate himself. He will destroy the nations that need to be destroyed. And he will vindicate himself and his people. Some imprecatory language there. But then Paul says in verse 20, to the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink, for by so doing you will heap burning coals on his head. Obviously, the Lord should be left in charge of implementing punishment and judgment and not ourselves. But I would suggest that Paul sees a further issue here. And that is that we have a difficult time as Christians learning to love our enemies. And without proper love and without proper love for our enemies, our punishment of our enemies would be skewed. It's only the Lord that has the complete balance. And therefore, I would suggest that praying to the Lord with imprecatory language is very much so necessary in our lives as Christians. But it also is a sign of a mature Christian. And those who understand first the concept of loving our enemies. And so I would suggest that we need to be working on loving our enemies before we begin praying any sort of imprecatory prayer to the Lord. Secondly, we can learn from Asaph that praying for destruction and vindication as a Christian requires a huge amount of patience and trust in the Lord. In Proverbs chapter 20, Solomon says, in verse 22, do not say, I will repay evil. Wait for the Lord, and he will deliver you. While our suffering today and in today's culture is much different than it was during that time, we don't have nations that are always fighting against one another like we do or today like they did then. There's a real sense in which we face an enemy that Paul says are not here on earth, but in the heavenly realms. And that is Satan, who is always devising and craftily planning an attack on all of us as Christians. And so imprecatory language seems very fitting for someone like Satan, asking God to vindicate us and to deliver us from his hands. But I would like to suggest that as we pray to the Lord and ask God to punish our enemies and even Satan, that it may be that he doesn't answer us right away. And so it's up to us to be patient and to wait on the Lord, to be on his timetable. And then finally, I would like to suggest that we pray for imprecations with a purpose in mind. Not only that the Lord ultimately be vindicated and be praised, but I think it's interesting what Asaph says in Psalm 83 and verse 16. After he gets done wanting them to be destroyed, he says, so that they may seek you. So that they may seek your name. This should be the purpose of the imprecatory language that we use to the Lord. Yet, how do you reconcile that with verse 17? Be put to shame and dismayed forever. I think Asaph truly loved his enemies. And while he wanted God to be vindicated, as well as the Lord's people be vindicated, he also wanted them to turn from their crafty and evil ways. Let's put it another way. Destruction from the Lord can only cause one of two things to happen. It will either push somebody farther away from the Lord, or it will humble them and cause them to change. You see that in Daniel chapter 4 with King Nebuchadnezzar, right? When he was punished severely, his nation was wiped out from under him. He was made to crawl like a beast of the field. What was it that he did? at the end. He recognized and extolled the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord as the Most High God. I would offer the same set of circumstances to each and every one of us tonight. Those who are not of the Lord are enemies of Him. And it may be that He vindicate Himself with His people. His punishment will either drive you farther away or bring you closer to Him. But either way, His name will be known. Either way. And yet one day there will be this final destruction, and then there won't be an opportunity anymore. He will have His final vindication, and then there won't be an opportunity for us to make a change. For those of us who are Christians, I encourage us to consider the challenges that are laid before us by Paul and by Asaph. We need to be maturing to a point where we hate what the Lord hates and can confidently cry out with imprecations to the Lord for our enemies to be punished. This, I believe, is the mark of a mature Christian. But this is rather hard for us because we first must learn to love our enemies and to pray for them. May we ask for the Lord to crush our enemies with the hope that they turn back to the Lord. If there's any way that we can assist anyone tonight, we encourage you to think strongly about your position with the Lord. Are you in the Lord's army? Or are you one of His enemies that is seeking to devise a plan against Him? I can say with certainty that no matter what, the Lord will make His presence known. And hopefully our enemies will be with us and we will be living together with the Lord one day. If there's any way we can help anyone tonight, we ask you to come forward as we stand and sing.